Well, hello everyone. Welcome to the second episode of Tribo Gatherings. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Smith, who's the technical manager now at PCS Instruments. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Fine.
Yeah, so the way we'll do this is we'll go through your journey through your kind of tribology kind of life. And so I suppose, yeah, what's your engineer, aren't you? You're an engineer originally.
Yeah, I did mechanical engineering at Liverpool University, and I was sponsored by what was then British Aerospace, which is a company in Bristol. So you worked there for a little bit before, and then you do some summers there. So they sort of stick you in the sort of, you know, reliability department for the summer, which is as horrendous as it sounds. And then you get sort of shoved around different places. But then they sort of try and make it sort of quite exciting, but it's really not. But actually the best summer was I worked in they called it mechanical technology, but they did lots of sort of testing. And there was quite an interesting bloke there. And he seemed to be sort of quite relaxed, and he'd sort of like say, oh, let's go for a little walk. I'll show you where they used to make Concorde. And then his little walk was like a mile and a half up the runway. And then he showed me where they sort of designed Concorde and showed me lots of sort of parts. And then he sort of encouraged me to say, you know, you shouldn't really just come and work here after a degree. You should do a PhD or something. So I sort of thought about it, but I wasn't really sure.
Oh, fair play. Where was that?
In Filton,
yeah.
Yeah, so that runway is all being built over now, but that's where the original Concorde used to fly from. So the runway is just massive, so that the whole of that whole site was sort of, Rolls-Royce were there as well, so it was kind of split over.
Yeah, it's a museum now, isn't it, with Concorde, and you can go and walk around.
Yeah. So he showed me sort of lots of the old drawings and how it was all done in the old days. So it was good.
And then, so you obviously joined Imperial College.
I worked in Greece for a bit. I went to work on some yachts in Greece for a couple of years, and then I got a job in Sheffield after I came back, and that was okay, but it was, you know, wasn't really what I wanted to do. And then I was thinking what to do, and then I saw an advert in the Guardian newspaper for a PhD in tribology.
Really?
Because this was like back in 1993, I guess. So hard to believe, but before the internet. Well, practically before the internet. So then, although I'd done mechanical engineering, I hadn't really heard of tribology. Well, you know, it wasn't ever mentioned anywhere. So yeah, then I came down to Imperial and got interviewed by Hughes Bikes. So,
but Hugh would have been fairly. No, he's still kind of into his career then in '93, was he?
He wasn't professor though.
No.
So he was, and he wasn't. He was in his 40s, but he was, he was just quite enthusiastic, talked a lot about tribology. And then the PhD was sponsored by Pennzoil, who were based in the US. So he said, oh, if you do this, there'll be lots of travel to the USA. And so I said, oh, great, yeah, sounds great. That's all I was interested in, really. I just thought it sounded like much more interesting than working in Sheffield.
Who was the academic supervisor then?
Well, Hugh.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, the industrial.
Oh, Zelda Gunsell.
Oh, really?
At Pennzoil. Yeah. Oh, okay. So she went on to be president of STLE and is now a director. But Pennzoil then were quite a small company. She hadn't been there that long. So they were in Woodlands, which is about 50 miles north of Houston.
Yeah.
Sort of quite a little office. And then after I finished my PhD, Pennzoil were taken over by Shell. Okay. And then Zelda went to work for Shell, and now she's a vice president.
Oh, yeah, she is.
Yeah. So I got quite lucky with both my academic and industrial supervisor.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah,
got very lucky.
Just purely by chance.
Well, you made them what they are.
Well, no, I think I just happened to get two people who were sort of on an upward slope at that particular time. You know, it was a bit of a coincidence, really.
What was your PhD? Is EHD?
It was polymers, so viscosity modifiers, or as they were called then, viscosity index improvers.
Yeah.
So the behaviour of viscosity index improvers in concentrated contacts, which is obviously a, you know, fascinating subject in its own. So it was loads and loads of EHD testing, you know, which I enjoyed. Yeah. And yeah, we found some quite interesting things. So it was good. Yeah, and Hugh was a good supervisor.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure if I'd have said that at the time, but he was, you know, sometimes it got a bit intense, but it was good. It was a good time to be in the lab.
Yeah. How big was the tribology lab there then?
It was really small. It was like six or eight people. you know, now it's what, like 40?
I don't know, yes.
It's huge. Quite big, yeah. Yeah, it seems to be. But it got bigger. There was, yeah, when I first started, there was about 6, and then by the time I left, there was nearly 20. So, yeah, it was good. There was a lot of different nationalities. Everyone got on well. It was good. It was a nice mix. Yeah. You know, it's a nice blend.
Who else was there at the same time?
Hans Rutlin. So he was doing his CV joints at Greece, okay. Sponsored by GKN. So Richie was his supervisor. Yeah. And Gareth Fish was his industrial supervisor. He used to come along. Now, Ian Lee Prudhoe took over. That Hans finished that project, then Ian Lee Prudhoe took over that. So he was using that sort of reciprocating rig. You know, the one that went on to be the Love Machine.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Monica, you know, she's now at Southampton. So she was doing emulsion testing, which is not easy actually on an EHD rig, but experiment, you know, she's a really good experimentalist, really good at running the rig. It was quite a difficult project. Yeah. So she did that. There was a guy called Gao who went to work for Ford. Okay. So he was doing a lot of modelling. So he was up in the computer room a bit, and he did a bit of experimental work as well. Jan Endhoven was just leaving by the time I left. Rob Dry Joyce was just leaving. Maggie Aldrin Paycock was there for about the first 4 or 5 months. So she explained like the workings of the HD rig, and obviously no one knew then she'd be end up being famous, but she's really good. She was even then really good at explaining stuff. She just seemed to have a natural talent of sort of like, you know, telling people how things worked and stuff. And she was really enthusiastic as well.
She's lovely, isn't she? She's brilliant. She's like pops up in kids' TV shows all the time.
Yeah. So when I started, she'd finished all her experimental work and was just trying to write up, which back then was on an ancient Mac, you know, which wasn't really designed to have a sort of 400-page document. It used to sort of just regularly crash and lose work and stuff like that. It's not like now. It was quite...
I remember that when, like, you know, you'd be writing. I wrote my thesis in, and I'd save as multiple versions, like each new file, knowing that if a file was corrupted, you could easily go back. But now it's not really an issue, is it?
No. She just was continually walking around with handfuls of floppy drives that would just like be corrupted, or she'd lose stuff she'd done. It was quite tense, and I think, you know, now people know just. You know, they're much more sort of familiar with it. But back then, it just ended up being one big horrendous document that was all sort of interlinked. And then if one bit goes wrong, it just ends up being a horrible spider's web.
Yeah. Oh, nice. So you finished your PhD. When did you finish? Like 96,
97?
98.
Yeah. So 94 to 98. Yeah. So yeah, by the time I'd left, there was a lot more people in the lab. Yeah. So it was getting sort of quite busy.
Yeah. Where'd you go then?
Then I went to work for a company called Intravascular Research because Penzoil wanted me to work for them. So I sort of thought quite hard about it. And Zelda was trying to be quite persuasive, but I really wasn't that sure about going to Houston. So I worked for a company in London doing medical research. So sort of nothing directly to do with tribology, but it was interesting for a short time. Yeah. And then PCS called and said, oh, we're looking for someone. Yeah. So I already obviously knew John and Clive. Yeah. You know, because they were still, when I started, they were still running PCS from a single office. They were up on the, I don't know, 14th floor of Ilakenge in a little tiny room. And then by the time I'd left, they'd moved out to West London. So I just sort of went in one night and just had a chat. But I already knew them because, you know, I'd been sort of running their rig. So it wasn't really like get to know you interview. It was just about, you know, what the job was and what it sort of entailed. So it sort of seemed to be the right thing to do at the right time.
Yeah, how many people were there when you joined?
Six.
Six, yeah, yeah. So quite small.
Yeah.
So it's like 30 now? Yeah.
Yes, there is 30.
So yeah. But like, I suppose like in the early days then when you joined PCS, what rigs did you have then?
Well, they had the MTM that I'd never used, so the first version of the MTM. So I'd used mostly the HD rig and a bit of the HFR. Some other rigs as well, not sort of PCS, but so I was really familiar with the HD rig, but the MTM rig had sort of evolved there. And the interesting thing is when they made the first MTM rig and then they didn't sell another one for 2 years. So it was a long time.
The first, Charles Bovington had the first one?
Of course,
one?
Yeah.
He had the first one.
Yeah, so he was, yeah, Charles Bovington with Infinium, or probably Paramins as it was then. Yeah, bought the first one. And then... I suppose back then there wasn't any sort of direct marketing because I think they still weren't going to conferences or exhibitions. But it took a while to sort of to take off. And then by the time I joined, there was quite a lot. We had quite a lot of EHD rigs, and then the MTM just sort of gradually picked up. Yeah, it was good. It was a good time to be there.
Do you do much like research there now, or is it what was your kind of job at PCS at the start, and what do you do kind of now?
Well, it was completely undefined at the start. So they just sort of, well, it was quite a lot of installations and training and just sort of troubleshooting, yeah, dealing with customer inquiries, which I still really do, you know, and I do quite enjoy that, yeah, you know, just meeting different customers, seeing what they've got to say. Just sort of dealing with, you know, lots of day-to-day inquiries and stuff like that.
That's how I met you.
It is.
I was working at Infinium and had problems with the MTM, and I used to call you.
See?
There you go.
Yeah, so initially, when I first started, it was weirdly mostly on the phone. Email was, it was sort of all right. And then when we first started using, like, photos on an email, it was a bit, you know, it was quite revolutionary. It sounds weird now, but we had an old camera with a massive SD card. So you just had to take the picture, and then you had to transfer the SD picture to your computer that seemed to take ages. And then you couldn't drag and drop or anything. You had to attach it to an email in a really odd way. And a lot of people who received emails couldn't seem to open it for some reason. It wasn't like it is now. It seems completely weird. And, you know, the idea of doing a video call was just like, you know, miles away. And we still had the fax machine, of course. So you used to get technical inquiries through the fax as written documents. So they wouldn't write an email. They'd type it up and put it into the fax. So then we'd write something on the computer in Word, print it out on a piece of paper and fax it back, yeah, which sounds weird now.
Yeah.
But all that changed fairly quick, I suppose.
So it's like, yeah, so if back then, if someone ordered an instrument and you were sorting out the installation, a lot of that would happen on the phone or fax or something.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, to be honest, it was emailed quite soon. Yeah. But yeah, there was still a fax. I mean, we only switched off our fax machine about 3 years ago, because we still used to get some purchase orders through the fax. So if you're still receiving purchase orders through the fax, you're a bit loath to sort of turn it off, because that's the sort of stuff you want to receive. And, you know, there's a couple of companies that, yeah, they still resolutely stick with the fax. So it's, yeah, it's funny.
I suppose, what kind of research are you doing now at, like, PCS? What are you kind of working on that you're happy to talk about?
I could talk about anything. What we'd really like to do is concentrate on getting some standard test methods, you know, working with some standard organisations and just sort of seeing what they want to do. I mean, to be honest, now, a lot of the new stuff we do is, if people are interested in a rig, we'll offer to sort of do some tests for them or run some tests. And then, because of the way the industry is going, there's new fluids, new additive types. They want information about, is this test going to work? You know, and so you need to sort of try and find out what they're trying to work out, what they're trying to establish, and then develop new tests and new test methods. Maybe on an existing instrument, yeah, or see if there's a market for a new instrument. But it's a lot of that rather than the sort of fundamental stuff. Because if you're working for a company, you don't really have the time to just sort of wander off and do a 3-year research project. But you sort of keep it in the back of your mind. So I'm still doing a bit. So we've got a paper coming up for STLE, you know, on some MTM mapper, looking at different techniques, new techniques. But yeah, the whole EV side and, you know, water-based fluids, all that sort of stuff. People want to know how that'll work. And then looking at different atmospheres, you know, that sort of stuff is still really interesting. Yeah. So I think because it's evolving and no one knows, you know, which fuel is going to be next or which, you know, what the way the whole fuel market's going. Because everyone thinks, you know, EVs will just take over, but there's still markets for that.
Yeah.
So we're starting to look at methanol. There's some work looking at methanol for fuel. So methanol's not a particularly good fuel, but it's biodegradable. So, you know, that's the good thing. The bad thing is, because it'll just absorb water, so, you know, there's obviously handling things and lots of things for testing that you wouldn't really think about. But for shipping, it might be a good fuel.
Yeah. In terms of, I see you've I'm guessing you did a lot of the work on the high pressure HFRR. What's the primary kind of application for that rig?
Well, the primary one was when we were approached a long time ago by a company that was, there was some Japanese and Korean work going on. So someone from Korea came to see us and said, "Oh, we're looking at DME, dimethyl ether, which is a gas, but it turns to liquid at about 5 bar, so relatively low pressure, and that can be just used in a diesel engine. Although it has naturally terrible lubricity, so it needs lubricity improvers." So they were sort of looking at that as a sort of direct alternative. So that sort of area of using DME as a direct replacement for diesel probably won't happen, but it may happen. The trouble is lots of these alternative fuels, no one knows which one's going to work and how it's going to go. So if you're going to be the first to do something, you've just got to try it. I mean, that's what Hugh Spikes always used to tell me, just try. Don't, you know, you don't have to be right. It doesn't have to work. So until you try it, you won't know. So we sort of developed that. And then the thing with the DME is it's fine and it's good as a fuel, but it's still combustion. Yeah. So you're still causing, you know, CO2. You're still having, you know, problems like that. So it doesn't get rid of it, but it's kind of useful. But it may be used in a number of applications. It might be just used as a carrier fuel for hydrogen. But then when we got that rig, lots of people would seem to be quite interested in it because you can completely control the atmosphere. Yeah. So, for example, if you're looking at methanol lubricity, if you have it completely sealed, it can't absorb any more water during the test because it's a completely sealed test. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking at, you know, how things behave under an ammonia atmosphere or something, it needs to obviously be completely sealed. And even how things behave in hydrogen, you can't have any leaks at all. That needs to be completely sealed as well. So having that completely controlled is good. And it's also not an easy test. It's not a sort of straightforward test, which is harder work, but in the end, it makes it more rewarding. So that's what I quite like. Not doing the hard stuff on purpose, but doing the sort of more difficult, interesting stuff because it's going to be, you know, nobody else is really doing it.
So it's completely sealed, is it? Or is there a move-in interface seal?
There's some convoluted bellows.
Oh, it's a bellow system. Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
So yeah. There's a bellow system. So one's going one way and one's going the other way. So one's in compression, one's in tension. So as they oscillate, so then you're not changing the volume in the actual chamber. So by having two, and so it doesn't need to go very far. It needs to go 2 millimeters. Yeah. So it's quite a neat system. Yeah, yeah, it just doesn't. So far, it sort of seems to be working quite well. There's quite a lot of interest in it.
Yeah, I bet. So it's like quite a nice little straightforward instrument if you just want to have a look at how the gases will affect metals, and then if you open up quite a large area to research. So it's quite a nice little rig, really, I bet.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, because I mean, you know, as you know, if you measure the wear or the lubricity of anything, if you measure it in oxygen and then you measure it in nitrogen, the results are completely different. You know, and there's huge differences, and it's not always the way you expect. Yeah. I mean, you know, generally if it's nitrogen, you get lower wear, but not always. And Hugh Spikes is doing some work on it, yeah. And Janet Wong. So there's lots of work on it in Imperial, and they found some really interesting things.
I bet there's loads of work on hydrogen as well in various guises.
Yeah.
You know.
And ammonia as well.
Yeah, ammonia I've seen.
Yeah. There's a lot of interest in lots and lots of new things. So people, yeah, like I said, people don't know which way, you know, fuels and lubricants are really going to go. The only thing we do know is it's going to change to something.
Yeah, exactly.
So all we've got to do is try and work in those areas.
And on the lube side, obviously there's some people, well, there's quite a lot of people working on water-based fluids. You know, I know here we have issues testing them on various rigs. Are you doing anything about that at PCS?
Yeah, we're going to look at having a circulating system added onto some rigs, yeah. And then obviously corrosion is a problem as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's going to be a sort of a challenge for sort of anyone. But it's also a challenge in the system that they're running in.
Exactly.
So you know. I know some water-based fluids, they give, you know, completely fantastic results, really low friction. But I'm not exactly sure how they behave in the long term.
Yeah.
I mean, a few people are really excited about them, though.
Yeah, they're quite interesting. Some of the ones I've seen, you know, which are close or in production, they have quite a good, like, you know, equal film thickness, but the lubricity, the natural lubricity is really low. And they get all kinds of crazy, like, wear modes when we test them. So, but I don't know how they do in the field, but they don't, like, compared to just normal hydrocarbon oil, which is always brilliant in a lot of the tests, they don't look great.
So no, but
they must be used and successful somewhere, but, you know, to the untrained eye, I suppose, they don't look brilliant to start with.
No, but this is the sort of advantage of bench testing, really, because, you know, everyone knows that bench tests have limitations and they're not perfect, and it's just looking at something initially. But it does mean that you can try lots of things, because you wouldn't want to just sort of start adding lots of water-based fluids to a full engine test or a full road test or something and just hope for the best. At least if you do these bench tests, you know, you'll get a much, much better idea before you start. So it's definitely worth doing, and yeah, we're seeing a lot of the rigs being used.
You know, I know where the drivers come in from, especially in the EV world, where obviously the cooling capacity of water is a lot higher than oil. So if you can convert to use water in those systems, you have a, you know, the cooling and the heating is the main driver for the electric vehicles. A lubrication second, really, but I'm not sure if any of the water-based fluids are used in the EVs yet. I think it's still hydrocarbons in the gearbox, but
yeah,
I guess that's the way they're going to go.
Yeah, primarily, but yeah. I mean, the heat generated is enormous, so anything you can do, yeah, you know, and you're right, you know, water-based fluids have just got an exceptional sort of ability to remove the heat.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, what's going to happen in the next kind of few years, do you reckon, with you at PCS?
With PCS?
What are you working on now?
Oh, well, there's a number of different projects. I can't really sort of talk about too many. They're sort of more leaning towards the sort of the EV side. You know, so there's obviously sort of demands for much higher speed, sort of different materials, different sort of tests. Not all EV, though. I mean, you know, we're looking at some other tests as well. So, you know, lots of interesting things happening. In the fuel side, there's still lots of SAF, sustainable alternative jet fuels, so alternatives to jet fuel. I mean, that's going to be a market that just continues to grow and grow, I think. I mean, they keep on setting really ambitious targets that I don't think are really going to happen, but you never know. And then replacement for diesel and petrol fuels, you know, we're not sure quite what will happen. Sort of renewable fuels. I think people will be trying lots and lots of different things for fuels. All sorts of probably exotic things. So we do get more and more inquiries about, what's this product going to do to my rig? Is it okay to test it in this rig and stuff? And then sometimes we really don't know what they mean, and they're a bit vague about it, but, you know, just give it a try.
I was just thinking about it. Your rigs are probably at the forefront of getting the brunt of the new technology, because once it reaches a more standardized test, you know, which would probably be more expensive and things to run, and they're a bit harder to run outside its normal operating conditions. So your rigs probably see like the brunt of the bad stuff, as it were. You know, the you'd be screening things which will never make it into the field.
Yeah, and then until people try, they won't know. And also, the standard test may not be applicable. Yeah. So, you know, lots and lots of the tribology and the standard, not the tribology test, but lots and lots of the standard tests are really old now. You know, there hasn't been much evolution in getting new standards and new test methods, although the fluids are completely changing. Yeah. So we're sort of, you know, we're really, any change like that is exciting and interesting. So we're really trying to keep an eye on that and looking out for sort of new developments that we can make with standards in mind, or a standard test in mind at least, or something that might develop, might come out to produce that. But everyone's just kind of, they're sort of skirting around the edges of it, really. No one's diving in. I suppose Toyota dive in a bit. They're always up for sort of making lots of things, because they made a full hydrogen car. I mean, there's not many, and there's 15 hydrogen filling stations in the UK.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that there's quite a few in California, I think.
Yeah, there's more in California. Yeah. And I mean, I think, so yeah, there's a few, you can buy, you know, a hydrogen car. Yeah. From Toyota, which, you know, we never really thought would happen. No. So I don't know if that's really going to take off. I mean, but then that's a hydrogen combustion engine, isn't it? It's not a fuel cell.
No. So make a noise and be fun to drive.
Yeah, and then they they keep on pouring water out of the exhaust, don't they?
Yes, cool.
It's like they're going to the toilet all the time.
Do you get involved in like the bio? We had Connor on last week. Did you get involved in the biotribology side at all?
Or? Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, we're getting lots of inquiries about that. Yeah. Lots of things about wine.
Wine?
Yeah, there's been doing lots of testing with wine, looking at sort of...
Not just drinking it, testing just it.
Drinking it as well, but astringency, you know, in relation to that. Yeah. Lots of things with texture as well, you know, because, you know, people keep saying there's no such thing as a texture machine. But probably the MTM is as close as you're going to get, because there is a correlation, or there seems to be a correlation, you know, between what people perceive as texture and what you can get from the MTM. Because the thing about the MTM, if you're looking at a number of different sort of products, you can have a product and you can measure it on a rheometer and it'll give exactly the same results. Yeah. Two products, you'll have a low-fat version and a high-fat version. So they've got the same bulk viscosity. Measure them on a rheometer, essentially, they give the same results. But you measure them on MTM and you do get different friction curves. So that's where it's good, because that can really discriminate the two, whereas standard tests don't seem to be able to.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, we've seen a lot of the MTM data, and to be fair, it looks pretty good. You know, like it's always hard then, is correlating it to human perception seems to always be the difficult bit.
Yeah, but I think that everyone acknowledges that that's a difficult test. Yeah. That's the difficult part. No one is ever going to say, oh, correlating this to perception or what people feel is easy. Yeah. That's going to require a lot of tests and a lot of sort of, you know, perception. People's perception sort of varies a lot as well. So those sort of things, I think, are really worth pursuing and working hard on, because the rewards ultimately will be quite big, I think.
I suppose it's good it's quite complicated, because if it was like easy and the first test we ran correlated perfectly to a panel test, well, wouldn't have much to do then.
No, exactly. And also, if it was really that easy, everyone would be doing it.
Exactly.
You know, it wouldn't necessarily be, because it was like, you know, you could may as well just measure the viscosity of something and then say that correlates exactly.
I personally think it's changing from, a lot of people use the PDMS, like, you know, samples to mimic the different flesh and things, but I think improving those will be the next step. Like, well, I think a lot of people do textures already, don't they? And then, but having some chemical, you know, mimic of tongue, and you know, I think that's where that to me is my next challenge. I think what I'd like to work on is that.
Yeah, definitely. It's all about the interface. It's not really about the bulk properties. Yeah. So, you know, we're making these sort of smooth PDMS balls and discs. But it's not really, that's fine if you just want to measure some bulk properties. Yeah. But you really want to get into the interface, see what's happening in the mixed and boundary regime, which is where all the magic happens anyway.
Exactly.
And then you're just, you know, you've really got to control and have a full understanding of what's going on. And that's not an easy test. No. But like you said, that makes it more interesting. It no one wants an easy test.
Yes, as I was saying earlier on, isn't it? When we do some of our biotribology testing now, like, I think I walk around the lab in a circle doing something every 2 or 3 minutes. You know, such a convoluted test, you know, but it works really nicely. And the cleaning procedure as well is really difficult. You have to be really clean.
Yeah.
You know, you won't get away with just using some solvents. You have to use, like, really good, like, anyway, I won't go through it all, but it's a 5-part cleaning process.
Which getting that nailed down, you know, is really good. It's just, you know, I see lots of people running an EHD film thickness rig, and you have to go through, you know, this is the test, this is the cleaning procedure. You can't do it in a rush. No. There's a certain sequence that you should do and have to do, and it just directly affects the results. Yeah. You know, you're trying to measure film thicknesses down to a few nanometers. It's really, really important otherwise it's sort of wasting your time a bit, really. So it's worth the effort, because ultimately the rewards and the good results is really good. And yeah, seeing nice repeatable results that really correlate, it's a really, really good part of the job, I think, because people really appreciate it.
They do, yeah. It's the main kind of benefit we give to industry, isn't it, is faster, cheaper tests. And so we can explain Stribert curves or talk people around results any which way we want, but all they want to have at the end of the day is some number or some kind of rating that they can relate to real life or show their product is better than the competition.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's always, well, that's always the challenge I've been working on. You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, I mean, and people love it if they can get a really nice result that shows their product next to a competitor's product, and then it's clearly defined discrimination, and it's repeatable as well. So you don't have overlapping error bars. You've got like nice repeatable results. This is, those sort of things are really easy to sell, and that's what the salespeople and the marketing people really like. They want something that they can understand and show on a graph or show some numbers. They don't have to fully understand it. But if it's got friction on the y-axis, it makes it a lot easier to sort of just explain, yeah, look, this is our product. This is looking really good. And this is, you know, competitor X or Y.
In terms of, I don't think you guys at PCS are yet, but something I've been thinking about is how to utilize like the digital side of Tribology as a service. You know, for example, James Ewan's molecular dynamic simulations and that type of thing, how to do that type of work and offer it as like support. You know, I don't know if PCS have thought about this.
I think that people have been talking about it and thought about it. We haven't really got anything going at the moment, but you're right, it's coming. Yeah. So we should be involved and should be sort of keeping an eye on it. I mean, there's more papers in that area anyway. Mm. There's more sort of research and there's more interest. Yeah. So I think, you know, ultimately we'd like to know that, you know, models are correct and they correlate nicely with sort of results. It's what people ultimately want, is a full understanding of exactly what's going on.
No, it's interesting. I'm not sure how to do it. I know there's like some software packages like KISSoft is used for like gear calculations, and there's some various bearing calculation softwares and things. So maybe the kind of market's nailed down, but... It's GT Suite, which used in engine simulations as well.
Yeah.
There's a few of them. I don't know. I was just wondering if you guys had a look at it and wondering if there's a way kind of in there, really. Obviously, you can do the modelling and kind of correlation work, the statistics and the regression analysis and that type of thing. Well, you've got your new chatbot as well, of course.
Yeah, of course. Chatbot on the website. So we'll see where that leads. No, I mean, using the right... test data to feed into these models is kind of really good, because I think the good thing about the models is they can accept lots and lots of data. Yeah. So you can try sort of different parameters from different tests, feed it all in, and then it'll sort of magically tell you which one's the best, rather than someone just looking at some test data and sort of trying to decide. So that side is kind of really good. I mean, there's a lot of work done years ago looking at sort of fuel efficiency of reference oils. Fuel efficiency, they had a number of reference oils. And then you can go through and work out a number of bench tests and see which bench tests correlate best to the reference oils. So, I mean, the trouble is there isn't an infinite number of reference oils. No. There's only about 7 reference oils. So if you get 7 different bench tests, you'll get perfect correlation, because obviously it's picking the best. So really you can only sort of pick 3 bench tests and then try and get those. But it's interesting to see which parameters correlated best to the sort of fuel economy data.
Yeah. The stuff I see, or the stuff I've had privy to in the past, is unfortunately it's quite boring normally, isn't it? It's like the viscosity obviously plays the largest.
Yeah.
Just measuring viscosity. And then, you know, what the base oil is can have a huge effect. Basically the traction. And then... boundary friction.
Yeah.
Quite small amount, quite a small effect is that the boundary, you know, the 1-3%.
Yeah.
The main effect is, you know, you can get about 10% fuel economy movement just in the viscosity.
Yeah.
And then you're tweaking then the boundary lubricant additives to in that 1-3% range to reduce friction there.
Yeah. But that's in the overall friction. So yeah, you're right. Like HTHS viscosity probably the best thing. But if people are specifically looking at changing boundary additives or formulating something, there's good ways of doing it and getting out those single numbers or something they can really correlate to, because then they can get treat rates. And you know what it's like trying to balance an additive package. You've got all sorts going on. So just having anything that can help is really good, because it'll really, you know, I think the worst thing that people really dread is just seeing a massive test matrix of every additive and every combination, because then you're just hoping for the best. At least having something to guide you maybe make it a bit easier.
Yeah. All right, well, let's try one of my. We've got some stock questions I'm going to start using. And what's the like? So we've got like you're marooned. This is a ripoff of Radio 4. So you're marooned on a desert island, and this desert island has a tribology lab. Yeah. And you're allowed to take one tribometer to use for the rest of your days. And I'm going to give you the Imperial College tribology notes, Sokoviak's book. And I think I'm going to add in Ashley Martini's new book as well, because I quite like that one.
Oh, okay.
There you go. So you get those books and you're allowed one tribometer. And I'm going to give you a viscometer.
Okay.
So what rig do you want to take?
I think probably something optical, because I did a lot of my PhD with that. Yeah. And so I was, you know, I think by the end of it, I'd got the hang of it. I could run it, but I was still finding out new things with it. Yeah. You know, even when I finished, you know, someone had to say, look, that's enough. You can't, you know, but it was good. And you get to see some nice pictures, some pretty, pretty colors, yeah, stuff like that. So I think, you know, that's probably an optical high-speed EHD rig or something like that.
High-speed one.
Yeah, yeah, with some digital cameras, because then I could always take a few selfies.
Yeah. Is your original, the one you used in your PhD, is it still in Imperial, or is it?
Yeah, they've put it in a little shrine. No, I think it all felt a bit. They all got sort of modified. Lots of the old EHD ones, they sort of hung around, and then they all sort of got changed, got added on. People started sort of measuring, sort of trying to do infrared temperature mapping. Looking at different things, changing sort of motors, doing some sort of the first high speed parts. Yeah. So that they all tend to get sort of modified slightly. Yeah, yeah. So that there may be a metal frame somewhere. Yeah. But
well, thank you, Matt. I suppose like I should say, well, thank you. And I suppose one other thing is like, thank you for all the support you've given like me and so countless other people who use the PCS rigs over the years, and you know, really appreciate it. So like, you know, you probably hear a lot of people complain about the rigs needing help and stuff, and you know, you've been very supportive.
It's good to see them being used. I mean, the worst thing is to go into a lab and see rigs that aren't being used. You know, that we do see occasionally, more so with other suppliers. But it's good to see the rigs being used and they're still coming up in conferences. You know, for us, it's something people really don't think about. But having other people present papers, lots of rigs being shown to be used, is really good. So that's a sort of, it's not a secret marketing tool, but I think it's something that people forget. So all this support, you know, and help that we give people, we don't have a charge for it. But it's good, and it's nice to see them being used.
Well done. Well, let's wrap up. Well, thank you very much, Matt, and thank you, everyone, and catch you all soon. Bye-bye.